and welcome to another edition of the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician and your host for this program. I'm also the senior-most faculty member at the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine, a place that I'm one of the founding fathers of, and still work, and we're about to start our new semester soon, so summer vacation's almost over for us in academia. And of course, Dr. Kamai is on the road, and she has the week off. So we have a great program today. I'm so thrilled to have on our guest, more thrilled than other guests, that's for sure, because online with us is Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. And we go way back, and we'll talk a little bit about our history. But Kara is a doctor of naturopathic medicine. She graduated from National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. And she got her postdoctorate in nutritional biochemistry and lab science at Metametrics Clinical Lab under Dr. Richard Lord. And this residency, she then moved to practicing integrative medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, and then wrote this fabulous book for the very scholarly and intellectual-minded listeners and, of course, practitioners, and that's called Case Studies in Integrative and Functional Medicine, and that's our topic today. She's also practices in Connecticut here, in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, really very close to me. And without further ado, Kara, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Dr. Z. It's
so happy to have you on.
Yeah, I'm great.
Long time coming.
I know. It's good to hear your voice.
I was gonna shame you, but I figured I'd do it in private. No, I'm only joking. The reason why is because Kara and I go way back. Kara used to actually work in my office years and years ago. And
I did. That's where I got my first real in-depth introduction. In fact, that's how I started. I started actually as a volunteer. I cajoled you into allowing me to shadow you.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, that kind of brings up a point. Like, why did you decide to become interested in naturopathic medicine and shadow me, and what about your experience working in my office made you love it so much that you wanted to actually do it for a living?
I know, it's amazing. Well, I think like many of us, I had my own health crisis. I developed chronic fatigue and certainly wasn't getting better by the usual doctor hopping and through the conventional hoops. I knew I wanted to be a physician, so that was something that I had already decided. But in my quest to find healing, somebody suggested I see Dr. Jeffrey Class, who's one of the pioneer naturopaths in our state as well. You know, and he's definitely got one of the earliest licenses. But he immediately put me on some great botanicals and some coenzyme Q10, and it didn't take a whole lot for his methods to restore me to balance, and I was impressed.
Yeah,
and
it's tough when you're sick and trying to function and work and you don't feel like doing anything.
Right, it's particularly with fatigue and with chronic fatigue and I needed to obviously do my own lifestyle management. I was burning the candle at both ends. I was getting ready for graduate school and kind of making those decisions and working, and I had a lot going on, and I just kaput. I just stopped being able to really function. So he returned me back to balance, and in that process it helped me make my decision, and then I knew I needed some real hands-on training. And so that's when I tracked you down. And let me tell you that I'm glad that you asked me what it was about your practice that really inspired me, because I remember it so vividly, and I hope you're okay with me telling this, but You're definitely, you're a teacher. Obviously, you're a teacher, and you've always, you know, and that was one of the stellar pieces of what you did with patients, and your method. You're probably still doing this, but your method at that time was to really write out the mechanism illustrated on the table paper. I mean, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Do you still do that?
Yeah, that's
and I would be running around after you.
No, I have my own handouts now, but sometimes I'll go. Not that patients are totally into biochemistry, but I try to make them understand, like, why are we thinking this way, where a orthodox allopathic doctor thinks this way. I mean, mm-hmm. we both have the same goal in mind, is to get people better, but we're coming at it differently, and we're also looking for other nuances as to what's happening with the very complex endocrine and other systems of the body, and connecting dots that don't usually get connected. That's what I love about functional and integrative medicine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was the inspiring.
That's those great.
But in particular, one of the concepts that you illustrated on multiple occasions, and I remember so vividly, this young boy with severe ADHD and his mom, and, you know, he wasn't getting any better, and he was on, you know, polypharmacy, as so many ADHD kids are, and you illustrated the concept of leaky gut, intestinal permeability, and, you know, how that would lead to food sensitivities, you know, malabsorption, nutrient deficiencies, and the dysbiosis, and, you know, systemic absorption of some of those molecules produced by the bacteria or the bacteria themselves, and you really walked through elegantly this mechanism, and I witnessed you do this enough where it was just I got it, and it was a real epiphany. But in this particular case, for some reason, it stands out in my mind. But that is such a fundamental underlying pathogenic mechanism, leaky gut, in so many of the complex chronic diseases that we address today, and you were writing about it, well, illustrating on table paper, you know, just such a long time ago. And I want to hear your comments on it, but I just want to also state first that, you know, you're finally validated in the literature. I mean, there's endless documents coming out every day backing up that mechanism as underlying many, many, many seemingly disparate complex chronic conditions. So
Yeah, it goes back to our old, well, I study with some of the great naturopaths. Not that we're not great. I think we're kind of at the forefront of changing medicine. And I always say, my new T-shirt, Kara, that I'm going to be printing out when I get to school is, healthcare reform is self-care reform. How do you like that? Cool?
Yeah, it is.
I think it's a cool bumper sticker because, you know, we're in a political time now, and this is what it's all about. And the only way to really make, I think, strides in healthcare is with self-care. And that's what teaching is about, and getting the patient to realize what they have to do to get well, and what are they doing in their lifestyle. But, yeah, back to, you know, leaky gut. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff on that. We'll get into that in a second there. But let's just get back to talking a little about yourself quickly. So then you did this kind of really cool postdoctorate thing, and this is where you learn, like, at a naturopathic school, where you certainly learn a lot, but you really were able to understand this field called functional medicine, and particularly several different tests that have come out of that whole genre of medicine, like the organic acid test, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Powerful tool. Powerful. The functional integrative medicine is sort of at the forefront of another sort of buzzword these days, and that's systems medicine, where, you know, we're taking into consideration, you know, the whole person and the person in their environment. So it's really, it is. You're right. Integrative, naturopathic, functional medicine, whatever you want to call it, is really at the forefront, again, of embracing new concepts and technology and research models and so forth. And urinary organic acids, which is basically looking at the metabolome. It's looking at your metabolism in action. It's looking at what you do, you know, the compounds that you produce and in what balances and how well you're making your energy, how well your mitochondria is functioning, you know, the organelle that makes our energy. And are you able to burn fat in the mitochondria? Can you burn carbs? I mean, are we looking at evidence of damage, oxidative stress? Can you, you know, are the various enzymes functioning optimally, or do you need more of the cofactors and coenzymes associated with those enzymes, which would be our vitamins and our minerals? So it's really, the organic acids is so cool because it's really allowing us to look under the biochemical hood of an individual and figure out exactly what they need.
Yes,
so rather
like
than
the
saying,
old,
oh, carnitine is great for burning fat, here, let me give you some, it's let me actually look and see whether or not you even need carnitine, and do you need a lot of carnitine? Are these pathways extremely imbalanced? Or,
yeah,
you know, it's individualized medicine.
Versus population-based, which is, like you were mentioning in some of your book here, that, you know, the lab work, it's funny, I call it like Leave It to Beaver medicine, because it's kind of like back in the 50s, these laboratory-based medicine became very popular. And people, you know, would go to the doctors and the doctor would draw the blood and look at a whole range of, like, where your cholesterol would be. And the range would be huge. It would be from almost nothing to a tremendous amount. I look at the hormones, for instance. Like, I do a lot of work with men's hormones. And the range is from 20s to thousands. And
I know, it's not helpful
and if
at
you
all.
Fit in this, if you fit in here, the medical doctor says that everything's okay and you're healthy. You're basically saying that you may want to be in this range, but there's an optimal range that you want to be in versus a suboptimal range versus a range that really isn't working for you.
Yes.
Comment on that for me.
Well, you know, conventional laboratory, they set the ranges very, very, very broad. They set them for high degree of specificity, meaning they want to be able to diagnose disease, period. Optimal health is not a consideration. They want to see disease. So if your testosterone is under 20, then you have hypogonadism.
Right.
No question asked, right? But if yours is 25, you know, it's still within normal limits. Of course, I'm sure that there's clear signs of it, but of testosterone deficiency. But the standard labs aren't designed to take this systems approach to look at multiple imbalances and how they impact the body as a whole. They're really they're designed to just identify disease.
Yeah. So then you started to do research into lots of these various labs that are done by, an integrative and functional physician, as opposed to, say, like a conventionally trained doctor. And with that, you, I guess, began to evolve a case studies book. Tell us about how that all happened with your book here, Case Studies in Integrative and Functional Medicine.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, just like you said, your calling is to shift the medical paradigm. I think a lot of folks that go in integrative medicine, we do have this, you know, this mission to really change the paradigm, you know, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And I do feel like this is a piece of my contribution. Like, let's actually show that this stuff works. Let's show that it works. In fact, I got institutional review board approval, so it's, you know, which is the path that you travel, copious documentation to just use it as sort of an offering to the research community, opening it for investigation, and just, you know, let's look at these as a collection of cases into integrative medicine and start investigating this more closely. And so case studies are really kind of the first step in research. But so it was a labor of love and my contribution to our, you know, to changing what we're doing in medicine.
So great. And I love teaching this, you know, stuff to the students at UBM. We'll have to have you down to do more lecturing on this particular field. But and now you're traveling, like you just got back from Hong Kong and you're working in your office. Nice.
Yeah.
Great for you. And teaching and writing and training. It's just great to hear you. So successful.
Yeah, it's busy. It's busy. It's exciting. I love to teach. So I'm working primarily with professionals. I think a lot of my education, I end up actually working with medical doctors who've had their aha moment and are moving into integrative medicine as they, you know, realize the limits of the conventional model. And it's really exciting to do it.
Well, that's a population that certainly, I mean, you know, a lot of the naturopathic doctors, you know, we maybe had the aha moment which made us get into the field. But, you know, when people are in the medical field and they're seeing, you know, the patient's not really getting well, like someone with, you know, of course, my expertise and knowledge in arthritis and my books and whatnot, but I want to talk to you about that in a second. Mm-hmm. When we actually talk about some case studies. But, you know, the patients are taking cortisone or steroids, Plaquenil, and then all the biologicals. And, yeah, they're walking around without pain, but if they get tuberculosis or somebody sneezes on them or they get a horrific outbreak of viral disease or pandemic,
cancer,
these people are in big trouble. And that's not really, I call it like living like the boy in the bubble. Mm-hmm. That's not really solving the whole dilemma that's happening in their body. It's actually just turning off their immune function without really investigating why it's gone awry.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about being that we both like our, you know, to treat, I mean, everybody, but nonetheless, we like rheumatoid disease. I think what got me interested in rheumatoid disease is that really, patients that have arthritis really need the full breadth of naturopathic care. They need to work on their diet. They need to work on their intestines. They need to clean up infections around the body. They need to make sure they're taking their antioxidants and their nutrition, and they need to work on their endocrine system, and they have to practice meditation and work on their body and keep themselves limber and do hydrotherapy and maybe fasting. I mean, it's just that's naturopathic medicine. And I was wow, that's a great illness model to see how our medicine can help.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely a systems imbalance. It's not just a disease of the joints. It's a systems imbalance. And my approach is similar. I mean, I guess anybody practicing integrative medicine would have to really start by looking at, you know, the gut. Intestinal permeability is well documented as an issue. Dysbiosis is a player. I mean, obviously there's some genetic predisposition, but really, I think at the end of the day, it's kind of minor. So we have to go in there.
How does the gut get so bad, Dr. Fitzgerald? What are some of the things that you see in your practice that people do that makes their guts, and tie that into the joints? How, I mean, you know, you might go to the gastroenterologist to check your gut out, but then the rheumatologist is checking the joints out, but they're not talking to each other.
I know. So many different factors can contribute to dysbiosis. I mean, gosh, you know, and as soon as you're exposed to antibiotics, you're initiating the process, and so that can happen in our culture. It happens extremely early on. I mean, that's just a real common player that's going to be one of the antecedent factors to developing, you know, whatever diseases you're predisposed to. So medications, not just antibiotics, but, you know, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. If you've got, you know, if you're taking ibuprofen or, you know, a whole host of them. Certainly blocking acid. And so medications are big. Probably at setting off the gut, setting off an imbalance in the bacteria and contributing to inflammation, and then also contributing to intestinal permeability, so allowing those larger, you know, the microbial matter to cross where it shouldn't, and being exposed to our immune system on the other side. So I'm sure that you've told your listeners, I'm sure they know that, you know, about 70% of our immune system is housed around our alimentary canal. So anything that crosses over inappropriately when the membrane, you know, when the enterocytes are excessively permeable, when the gut is excessively permeable, is going to be introduced immediately to our immune system. And if it's something abnormal, if the food particle is too large, or if it's a, you know, if it's something from produced by a microbe, I mean, that's not self. It's not safe. So that's going to initiate a cascade of inflammation, and, you know, there's the whole concept of molecular mimicry, not to get too complicated, but that can influence where the inflammatory response takes place.
So that's so, like, if, you know, a great example of molecular mimicry is like when you have strep in your teeth and whatnot, and you get a vigorous teeth cleaning, and then the strep travels to other sites in the body, and because the strep on a molecular level looks just like your heart valves, I mean, almost down to the molecule, it's pretty amazing, right down to the genetic amino acid sequences, you can actually have a case of mistaken identity and start attacking your heart valves thinking that they're the strep bacteria, and then you're in trouble.
Right.
Now, in your book, you talk about a lady, I believe, with arthritis, and her house flooded with mold.
Right.
So what does the environment have to do with these types of diseases?
Right. That was the initiating factor for her, which is, you know, it's, again, you can see it in sick building syndrome in people who develop rheumatologic conditions. I mean, it's well documented.
And it says here that she had about 6 years before the basement flooded, and
yep.
And
yes,
she started to get symptoms, and then they put her on all kinds of the drugs, which had all kinds of side effects. Of course, she lost her hair and had digestive problems and skin problems, and then she got real tired, for instance. She woke up unrefreshed and very tired, and then she started having hot flashes, cold flashes, and then she also had urinary tract infection. Now, that's kind of interesting because that's, you know, recent research shows that people that are housing UTI bugs often go on to get
yep.
rheumatoid arthritis.
That's right, that's exactly right. Yeah, Proteus in particular.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that, you know, you put that in your book there. And then, of course, I guess she came to see you, and you were able, like a good detective, to sort of follow these things and run very interesting laboratories. Like, you found she was low in vitamin D. She had reactions to foods, which, you know, that's interesting because we all eat. We eat every day. But we don't realize sometimes that the food is causing our symptoms. Maybe we think foods cause watery nose, runny eyes, and, you know, those types of allergies. But you're actually, in your book, very boldly saying that sometimes reactions to foods can cause joint problems.
Yes, absolutely. She had, and you know what's interesting, too, is that if you look at, you know, there's different mechanisms by which we mount an inflammatory response to food. So you can have the typical allergy, like you said, runny nose, what, you know, so as soon as you're exposed to, I don't know, a common thing might be peanut or something, immediately you have hives. Like, it's a no-brainer.
Right.
You're exposed to the peanut, you get hives. Well, we also have reactions that are delayed. And so we might not be able to perceive as quickly. We might not know at all that food's involved in our, you know, the underlying cause of our condition. And that was the case with this patient with NV, her initials NV. But she was exquisitely sensitive to a protein in milk called casein, just exquisitely sensitive to it. But, you know, until we really uncovered and treated her gut and treated the other imbalances and took those foods out for a period of time and she started to get better, she didn't know it. So So we become somewhat immune and less sensitive to what's going on with our body when we're in the, you know, in the throes of our illness. But an interesting story with her was she also had osteoporosis, which, you know, common in this patient population. And I had put her on a good bone formula, a really very well-designed bone formula for her. And I didn't look closely at the added ingredients. It was in our pharmacy, in our clinic pharmacy. So these are vetted products. And in this particular one, there was a little bit of that milk protein as a preservative. It's called sodium caseinate.
Right.
And she took that. Her joints swelled. Her hands and her elbows. Everything just swelled up immediately. In a matter of hours, she couldn't put her wedding rings on or.
Wow.
And she was just in terrible
pain.
That's
from that little bit of milk.
It was a milk protein. Yep. Wow. It was actually a minuscule amount of milk protein in this product as an additive. So she was really exquisitely sensitive to this. And yet, you know, during the course of her illness, she was eating dairy all the time.
And didn't make any connection to it. People think it's the staff of life, like wheat and dairy and, you know.
Right. She was actually also quite sensitive to wheat and, you know, and a number of other foods. But really, the dairy was the big the big issue with her at the end of the day. You know, once we heal the gut, usually people can eat most of the foods they've had to take out. It's not, you know, it's not a life sentence for a lot of them. But some key foods are, you know, they're really a lifetime out. They just seem to provoke the process, the disease process. So there was a psoriatic arthritis patient in the book also who similarly found all of his symptoms would flare immediately upon ingesting gluten.
Now, some people have overgrowths of these microorganisms living in their digestive system, and they may have all kinds of symptoms. They might be tired, get headaches, stomach aches, feel spaced out. And I know the test that you were working quite successfully with, one of the organic acid tests, can actually measure poisons that are given off by these microorganisms living in the intestine, and then these poisons get into the bloodstream and then get into the urine, and then you can detect them like a good detective.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Yeah, you can identify what we call, commonly, dysbiosis. So bacterial imbalance, dysbiosis. Yep, absolutely. And then you can go on and actually analyze what microbes are in the gut using a stool test.
So you would use this urine test to kind of point you in the right direction if someone had these vague, unwell symptoms that may not even have to do with the gut. They may, like I said, they may feel tired or have all kinds of other, they can't focus, they're spacey, or, you know, muscle aches and pains. And so you would kind of look at their, it's so funny because August 1st, my emissions is due for my car. And I was thinking, well, that's an interesting analogy for the show. It's like I have to prove to the Department of Motor Vehicles that my car is running smoothly and the guy sticks the thing up the tailpipe and measures the exhaust and can tell me whether my engine's running in my car. This test, you take someone's urine and you can see how their engine's running.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And a part of it is looking at, you know, do they have bugs in the gut that are out of balance?
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't tell which specific bugs they are, but you can definitely see if they're out of balance and whether or not you need to address the gut. There is one marker on the urine organic acid specific for a yeast, a fungus called Candida. And that's definitely, in my experience, been associated with systemic symptoms, fatigue, you know, irritability, maybe headaches, certain food cravings, and so forth. And I have one case, this just really terrific athlete, lifetime athlete, and she became fatigued. And she also actually gained a lot of weight over the course of maybe a year. Relatively rapidly, she put on at least 30 pounds. And she was still training, so she was still pushing herself. She was a triathlete at that point, but she had grown up a softball player and went to college on a softball scholarship. I mean, she was a full big-time athlete. So she's still pushing herself to perform and to train and so forth, even though she was absolutely exhausted. And when we did the organic acids test on her, the only real significant imbalance was that she had an enormous amount of this compound produced by candida. And she also had what we do, I'm sure that you check, I know you do tongue diagnosis because that's where I first saw it. I saw you do it. And she did have evidence. She had a thin white coat. It wasn't extremely thick or robust. It wasn't obvious. It was like a subclinical presentation of, oral candidiasis.
You know, like a thrush or something.
Yeah, like a mild thrush. But boy, her gut was out of control. So really we did a number of things. She had nutrient deficiencies and so forth, so we had areas we had to work with on her. But really, primarily, it was just getting in there and killing this yeast and boosting her immune system so that she could fight
it. Now, when somebody has yeast, Dr. Fitzgerald, when someone has yeast, you want to work with their diet. Are there things that people eat? I mean, we talked about antibiotics and things like that, but I know sugar is a big culprit with yeast problems.
Yes.
Was she eating a lot of sugar, this lady?
She was on a pretty typical standard American diet. I mean, it was somewhat healthy. You know, she'd been an athlete for a long time. But, yeah, it was pretty standard. The other thing with her, though, was, you know, we think of a lifetime athlete as being really healthy, but it can run your immune system down.
Oh.
And something can kind of overtake you. You know, like a little candida. You know, she just doesn't have the same ingredients to fight it. So we had to do some immune restoration with her, as well as get her on a, you know, quote, good anti-candida diet, which is low in sugar, low in simple carbs, that kind of thing. And she just did fabulous.
You know, I'm looking at the time. We have to take a break. And so we'll regroup and return. Again, you're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z with Dr. Kara Fitzgerald talking about functional medicine and some interesting cases. So stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back. We're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, naturopathic physician and host of the program today. And we have on with us my illustrious colleague. It's nice to say that, Dr. Kara Fitzgerald. And we're talking about her really great book, Case Studies in Integrative and Functional Medicine. It kind of, you know, I love reading this because it's kind of like following a detective thing where someone comes in with these vague, I don't feel well, and you go to work like a super sleuth, understand the symptoms like any doctor, but then the way you run these different tests and interpret them is just great. Like, for instance, depression is a big thing, and there are people that go on, you know, many types of antidepressive medication, and they may feel better for a while, but then the medication stops working, and then the psychiatrist puts them on something else, and then something else, and something else, and sometimes it never really even works. It never really addresses the depression. And I know you have a couple case studies about these types of things, and mm-hmm. I know you wanted to talk about that.
Yes, I think it's a great, great topic. First of all, I do want to just let you know that there are a number of different clinicians who contributed cases, so they're not just from my patients.
Okay.
I have four, but I do want to give credit where credit is due, because there's some really good doctors out there practicing integrative medicine.
Sure, that's fine. No problem.
So depression, yeah, so we really understand now that depression is, well, I think that there are multiple factors causing depression. I mean, and that is, just as a side note, before I talk about the case, one of the reasons why it's extremely useful, not that it can be, it's extremely useful to try to answer the why. And my particular way of doing that is using laboratory testing. Why does this person have depression? What are their imbalances? You know, what are their biochemical imbalances? What, you know, is their diet contributing, lifestyle, et cetera? You really have to cast a wide net. And each person's depression is different. But there is an understanding emerging now that depression is inflammatory. you know, almost like rheumatoid arthritis
wow.
or heart disease or all these other things. And so in the casebook, there's one individual who has sarcoidosis, which is an inflammatory, it's a profound inflammatory condition. And what we now understand is that when you're just generating a lot of the compounds of inflammation, you take ingredients from wherever you can get them. And one of the main ingredients to generate these compounds is the amino acid called tryptophan, which under normal circumstances will go on to make one of our main mood neurotransmitters, serotonin. It'll actually make one of our main sleep neurotransmitters called melatonin. So the body will commandeer it to fight the inflammation, and then one will develop a depression because of this other underlying untreated inflammatory condition. So in the sarcoidosis case in the book, he had a significant depletion of his serotonin turnover, and he had severe depression as well as insomnia. And so when the clinician in that case addressed those, he started to sleep, and his mood improved. He had a 30-year history of depression. So 30 years, 3 decades of taking many, many, many different classes of antidepressants and types of, you know, in the same class, you know, many different SSRIs. And
so the medication, Dr. Fitzgerald, the medication that they're on, the SSRIs, now, they will make sure that you're not breaking down your serotonin rapidly, but will they actually give you more serotonin?
Yeah, that's the thing. So he was what we call a non-responder. He didn't respond to his antidepressants at all because, no, it sure won't give you serotonin. Absolutely not. So if you don't have the ingredients to make serotonin are going elsewhere, you know, and oftentimes it's going towards inflammation, then those medications, no matter how much you throw at someone, they're really not going to work. Sometimes we see an imbalance as an inability to make serotonin, not just from, you know, having enough tryptophan, but we need folate to make serotonin. We need magnesium. We need vitamin B6. Indirectly, we need vitamin C. We need magnesium. I mean, there's a whole host of nutrients, many of which we don't get enough of.
Right.
To make normal amounts of serotonin.
So depressed people, or in this case, this patient, may be also low in these cofactors, which allows the body to take the raw materials and make them into the serotonin and melatonin, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yes. The cool thing about using a test like the organic acids, or sort of the forerunners of systems medicine, is that you can look and see, or if you do an organic acids with an amino acids, you can see, does this person have tryptophan, you know, or if they have tryptophan, do they actually have the folate or the B6? I mean, you can mentally walk through the synthetic pathway for serotonin or for dopamine or for adrenaline or, you know, for different things and piece together a reasonable hypothesis of what's going on, and then treat. And we're treating really safely. You know, we're using nutrients. And if you want to go on further, you could actually measure magnesium and zinc, and you know, you could measure directly if you wanted to. But oftentimes, this is sufficient information.
Well, that's fascinating because you know, still one of the number one killers is heart disease, hypertension, and I know you've done a lot of work looking at special types of folic acid that patients may need, folic acid kind of being in the B vitamin family,
yeah.
But they may need a special type of folic acid in order to make their body work. Talk about that a little bit. That's fascinating to me.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah,
so there are different types of folate. In fact, folic acid, that term is actually specifically reserved now for synthetic folic acid, so the stuff that we find in our foods and, you know, in our enriched wheat products and other, you know, other mostly grains. And that particular form is not always the best for people. It's really not. So there are the natural forms we're becoming more versed in, and in particular, there is a form of folate that's methylated. So it's called methylated folate, or there's a bigger name, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, if you want to go really, really big. But that particular compound helps make a cofactor. It helps make another compound in the body that goes around and does all sorts of extremely important, it performs all sorts of really important activities. And again, yes, it's involved in making serotonin. It's involved in making all of the neurotransmitters. It's involved in making thyroid hormone and pigment, just a wide variety of things, dopamine, epinephrine. It's even involved in making nitric oxide, which helps with blood pressure.
Right.
It's such an important...
And then it also goes to reduce homocysteine levels, which...
Yeah, that's right. Yep, in fact, that's the most well-known thing. Yes, so
you know, and that's tied into the heart... Well, yep. So is the nitric oxide, like you mentioned. That's pretty interesting. But it's certainly tied into homocysteine. And, keep in mind that, we have... We're on radio. We can't do a diagram out there. We should be on TV doing a lecture, writing out the biochemistry things on my lab table. But anyway, tell us a little bit about this whole homocysteine thing and why this is so intimately tied with heart disease. Like, doctors are on this whole Lipitor kick. Everyone's got to take Lipitor. Everyone's got to take these statins. But that's not really how a functional medicine doctor would approach heart disease. How would you do that and tie together homocysteine, CRP, and the whole type of workup that you would do?
So, homocysteine accumulates in a lot of conditions. Most famously, homocysteine has been noted to accumulate in those with increased cardiovascular risk or active cardiovascular disease. So it's a biomarker. An accumulation of this says this person has an increased risk for cardiovascular disease. Interestingly, though, so sometimes these biomarkers in and of themselves are benign. They just tell us, okay, here's a risk. But homocysteine itself can actually be, there's some interesting research in mostly in animals, it really shows that this compound itself can be damaging. So, and an accumulation of it, again, shows that there's an inhibition in extremely key, important, very fundamental physiological processes in the body. I mean, they're almost too numerous to mention homocysteine goes on to make an amino acid called taurine, and it's in the highest quantity in the heart, also in the retina. Interesting, homocysteine goes on to make an antioxidant in the body, the fundamental, extremely important antioxidant, amino acid called glutathione. If you don't have enough, there's all the oxidative damage. We will break the body down if you don't have enough of this. I mean, it's so fundamental. It's the molecular underpinning of disease, of age.
It causes inflammaging. It's like a combination
yeah, it sure
of
does.
Inflammation
right.
and accelerated aging process.
I mean,
so
yeah.
When you come in, you it says on your form you're 50, but I look at you and you actually look like you're 65 or 70. I mean, this is I don't tell patients that, but I'm thinking that, wow, they're really, their aging process, or they're aging much too quick.
Yes, and you can't move out toxins, so we all have a toxic burden.
Right.
We all have been exposed to metallic toxins, mercury, lead, et cetera, organic toxins, things we find in plastics and so forth. And homocysteine is a precursor to glutathione, taurine, and another product called sulfate. All of these are key in also detoxifying the body. So an accumulation of toxins will also go on and contribute to inflammation and you know, toxic burden and oxidase, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just these fun, extremely fundamental molecular underpinnings of disease across the board and of aging and of all of the things that we see today. So we need to recycle homocysteine. We need to keep those pathways open and moving. They're called methylation and then methylation, sulfuration, and homocysteine really kind of sits at the switch there. It's recycled to methionine under methylation with methylated folate, or it's shunted down into making glutathione. And it appears that we know that those have to work in tandem. They have to work together. So an accumulation of homocysteine could suggest not just an issue with recycling to methionine, but being able to make glutathione and so forth. Just extremely fundamental.
So it's fascinating. All these things connect, and we're talking a lot about antioxidants and things that really...
And all of our B vitamins and all of our minerals. I mean, this is where the rubber meets the road. I mean, we're looking at magnesium is here, potassium is here, B6 is here, niacin is here, thiamine. I mean, this is your B complex. So you wonder why, you know, your naturopathic doctor is putting you on a B complex. This is one of the reasons, or potassium, or, you know, this is it, or magnesium. I mean, we're all, virtually all of us are, you know, insufficient in magnesium and...
I've been using a magnesium gel on patients, which seems to have helped boost their magnesium. Have you used that before?
I have used it in kids who are not so excited to be taking lots of oral magnesium. Yeah. And yes, I definitely like it. Yeah. I think there's some good magnesium products on the out there now, but yeah, magnesium topical is great.
Now, also, let's just talk about the CoQ10 thing, because I'm looking at the time, and boy, it's flying by talking about all this stuff. But then we only have about maybe 7 minutes or so. But you know, so many people are on these statin drugs, and they're coming in with depression, fatigue. They can't exercise. Their legs hurt, and they have aches and pains all over the place. And you're finding that, and a lot of times, they're deficient in CoQ10, and their medical doctor really should be telling them to take, well, I mean, they should be coming probably to us so we can fix the cardiovascular system the right way, but nonetheless, temporarily, they're on the statins, and these statins are causing a tremendous amount of collateral damage.
Yeah, they are. I know. It's really kind of... heartbreaking. I mean, it's damaging, and so it does in fact stop cholesterol synthesis. There's no doubt about that. But the same pathway makes coenzyme Q10. The same pathway is also actually involved in participating in UV vitamin D synthesis. You will become deficient in CoQ10 if you're on a statin. I mean, it's been demonstrated time and time again, and you will become deficient, you know, really pretty quickly. I think one study was 2 weeks, you know, so rapid depletion when you shut this pathway down. Which means, so what is CoQ10 and why is it so important? Because CoQ10 is essential for making energy. I mean, it's as fundamental as that. So all these pathways we're talking about, glutathione and methionine and hormones and neurotransmitters and blah, 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 all of those need energy. All of those need ATP. And if you don't have CoQ10, you're not making your ATP sufficiently. And where is the ATP the most concentrated? I mean, you know, of course, in the heart muscle. That's huge there. You know, as well as skeletal muscle and so forth. So in an attempt to ward off a problem, you know, heart disease with the statin use, you're at risk of, you know, coming through the back door and introducing the same problem. But yes, the reason why there can be muscle pain and so forth, certainly one of them can be a damage.
I don't think many people realize that. The heart's a muscle, too. I mean, they kind of do, but they don't realize that the CoQ10 deficiency that's caused by the Lipitor, which they're being treated to lower their blood fats and to prevent heart disease, is actually inducing a cardiomyopathy, and their heart muscles actually slowly dying, or aging.
Yep.
That's pretty crazy.
I know. It really is. I know.
Oh, boy.
And maybe for certain individuals, a short-term course of a statin is indicated.
Yeah.
But I know that we can certainly go in much lower doses. And, gosh, you know, just on the radio today coming into my office, they were talking about wanting to institute cholesterol screening in kids with the follow-up being prescribing statins. And this was actually one of the people who was challenging this I'll have to look it up, but he was in a government regulatory agency. I'm pretty sure. So he was high up the food chain in the conventional world, and he was saying, you know, this may not be appropriate because some of these people making this decision are actually making money from the sale of statins, and so.
Oh, sure, I'm sure.
It's
way tied into that. And I know with your testing, you can actually tell if people are damaging their DNA. That doesn't sound too healthy to do.
Right.
But there are markers in that urine test.
Yep.
Where you know, you can see if people are destroying their DNA. Now, usually DNA is pretty well protected with, you know, folic acid and methylation and things like that, but I guess sometimes it can be open to assault if you don't have enough antioxidants and you don't have a lot of the things you talked about already.
No question, and that marker is well substantiated as, you know, increasing in a variety of different diseases from different cancers to heart conditions and so forth. So, yeah, it's basically increased free radical activity, increased oxidative stress, specifically to the DNA. Now, normally, we do have, you know, DNA turns over. We repair DNA regularly. We have mechanisms built in where we, you know, are regularly renewing and turning over our DNA just to kind of keep it new and fresh and functioning. But when this marker is elevated, we know that there's excessive turnover happening. So there's damage going on. It's too much.
I know if I went to a doctor, I would want them to tell me how many minerals do I need, what type of vitamin should I take, am I going through inflammaging too quickly, am I damaging my DNA, do I have all these bad bacteria grown in my body. Going to a doctor like yourself, you can help your patients answer these interesting questions and not just say, oh, you look good. I guess you're healthy. You know what I'm saying? This is this is very critical. So I'm really glad that you joined us today to talk about your book. Tell us a little bit about your practice and where people can get hold of you.
So I'm in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. I have a website, which is drkarafitzgerald.com. That's drkarafitzgerald.com.
That's Kara with a K, right?
Kara with a K. And I work with people all over the country, even outside in some cases, because I do a lot of teaching. And so I see patients or do telemedicine 2 days a week. And then the rest of the time I'm in it doing different education work. But people can reach my clinic either at info@drkarafitzgerald.com. So INFO, info. Or they can call us at 203-304-9502. And they can also email us through the website if they'd like to. And we have an e-newsletter, so people can go to the website and sign up for the e-newsletter there. And they can also get a little, you know, a better idea. Well, you've heard a lot about what I'm doing today on the show, but there's cases posted and that kind of thing. In fact, there's two cases posted from the book. You can read the full cases. The rheumatoid arthritis patient you were talking about, and also a good one on ulcerative colitis. But there's some other cases up there and you know, various writings that I've done over the years.
Amazing success story, and it's great to have you as a naturopathic physician and colleague from, you know, kind of our relationship over the years. And
well, you were my first teacher. I mean, you really, really, really were.
Oh, that's great to hear.
You were. I mean, you opened my eyes to this world in a very meaningful.
Hooray! And that does it for another edition. We got to let you go. It's time to go, but we'll have you on again soon. Stay healthy and stay in touch.
Bye bye.
Okay, and we'll see you too, folks. Stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network. Dr. Z signing out for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Stay healthy.